working world more jaded than a Walmart checkout girl, and not an eyebrow was raised, not a question asked. "I'll need 3 propane cylinders for the grill," she told the girl. Ellen left the store, waiting by the propane rack. Before long, a sales associate with a ring of keys came out, unlocked the cage, and removed the cylinders. Noticing that her cart was full, the boy offered to carry them for her. He made a big show of picking them up, but she could see that he was struggling the entire way to the car. Once they got there, he set them down by the back of the vehicle. "Thanks," she said. "I can take it from here."
"You're welcome," he said, rubbing his forearms.
When he left, Ellen opened the back door of the vehicle and called inside. "Pete, come back here and put these in the truck." He did as he was told, struggling slightly with the heavy cylinders, then got back in the vehicle. Ellen finished unloading her purchases, then got in the car too. Both kids were settled in their seats, sprawled out in apparent exhaustion.
"Too much work too early," Pete groaned.
"Can I go back to bed when we get home?" Ariel asked.
"Absolutely not," Ellen said. "Someone has to help me unload all this stuff and put it away."
"Aw,"
they moaned in unison.
"We all have to help out while your dad is gone."
"I hate the apocalypse," Ariel muttered, scowling and crossing her arms.
Chapter 4 I don't know what Lois and Alice did in their car, but we spent the beginning of our drive from Richmond doing something I hadn't done in a long time, listening to AM radio. Ever since I'd reached my teenage years and began listening to the FM album rock stations of the 1970s, where they'd play an entire LP of Dire Straits, Steely Dan, Eric Clapton, or whoever at a time, I'd avoided AM entirely. It was strictly the realm of fast-talking DJs, talk radio nutcases, and preachers. But FM signals travel shorter distances, and we couldn't pick up a single station on that band. When we switched to AM, there were fewer stations broadcasting than you would normally find, but there were some. Several were just looping the same emergency broadcast system message that I'd heard earlier. Some were broadcasting network news coverage of the terror attacks. The more we heard, the clearer the scale of the event became, and the more worried we became. With communication sporadic, much of the news being reported was coming from social media posts. Although we couldn't see them, newscasters were describing posted images of localized disasters throughout the country. Fires, flooding, demolition of infrastructure, and power outages were everywhere. Resources were stretched thin. In some areas, localities were having difficulty prioritizing their response due to the scale of the overwhelming need. In the intensity and emotional reactions, it was like the 9/11 terror attacks taking place all over again, except occurring in more places. Despite the scale of the attack, it didn't appear that there was tremendous loss of life yet, although numbers were certainly in the thousands. However, in terms of devastation, it might take years to get things back to where they were, if they ever could. I also knew that the death tolls would begin to rise rapidly as the disaster began to take a toll on the medically fragile and the unprepared. Some consultant interviewed by CNN said that the power grid could collapse entirely as small power plants, still generating, tried to keep up with demand. They urged people to make preparations and conserve resources.
"It's like they hit every weak spot we had at the same time," Gary said, thinking aloud.
We were on I-64, getting ready to exit to I-81 near Staunton, and Gary was driving. I was riding shotgun. Traffic coming out of Richmond had seemed almost normal. Maybe a little lighter than normal, like Saturday morning downtown traffic in any city. As the area we were traveling in, though, had not been hit directly, we didn't see many emergency vehicles responding to calls. But we passed numerous convoys of military and police vehicles traveling in the opposite lane. Perhaps they'd been called to Eastern Virginia to respond to events there, or maybe they were on their way to D.C. The other Impala with Alice and Lois pulled up alongside us, and Lois gestured to the side of the road.
They cut ahead of us and pulled over onto the shoulder. We fell in behind them. Lois came walking back to my window on the passenger side to stay away from the passing traffic. I rolled my window down. We all looked at her expectantly. "I need to take a potty break," she announced. We all continued to stare at her, saying nothing. When no one responded, I pointed to the bushes alongside the road. "Go ahead," I said. "We'll wait on you." She looked aghast. "I will not tinkle on the side of the road like some drunken redneck," she hissed. "Besides, I'm hungry. I haven't had anything to eat since I got up." Gary, fighting a smile, leaned over toward my window. "There's a travel plaza ahead, Lois. We need gas anyway. We'll stop there. I'm sure we can all use a break." I already had my mouth open to comment when a voice came from the back.
"Don't say it, Jim," Randy said.
"She already thinks you're a dick." "Be nice, you guys," Gary warned, fighting back his own smile. "She's someone's mother." "Yeah," I mumbled. "Satan's." We drove about 10 miles more and took the exit for the Carson Travel Plaza. It was the largest travel truck stop for 100 miles and had a lot of gas pumps, good coffee, and clean bathrooms. I'd stopped there many times while making this trip or going on vacation with my family. As we approached it, though, I realized I'd never seen it this crowded.
"What the hell?"
I mumbled, seeing the line of cars stretching from the pumps back out into the road.
"There's the problem," Rebecca said,
pointing to a large plywood sign propped up by the road. "Fuel sales limited to 5 gallons per vehicle."
5 gallons? I said. "That won't get you anywhere."
"Looks like you'd have to wait about an hour or two just to get your 5 gallons, Gary commented. "Maybe Lois can hold it a little while longer," I wondered aloud. "This is a damn mess."
"She's not gonna hold it," Randy said, smiling. "She's not gonna tinkle on the side of the road like a common drunk."
I laughed. Even though I didn't know Randy all that well, anyone who made fun of Lois was all right in my book.
"You guys shouldn't pick on Lois," Gary said. "She's a sweet old lady."
"I think you mean sour old bitch," I muttered.
"No," Gary replied, "that's not what I mean at all. That's just not even nice."
Lois whipped out of the line of vehicles and cut around them. It was clear that this line was just for the gas pumps. Despite some horn-honking and obscene gestures, she made it to the front of the store and took the only empty spot nearly in front of the door. She immediately bolted from the car and into the store.
"I think she took a handicap spot," I said, "but I ain't saying nothing."
Randy snickered in the back.
"If you guys don't mind walking, I'm going to park a little farther away," Gary said. "I don't want to park in the middle of that mess."
"Fine with me, too," I said.
"Me too," Rebecca said. "I need to stretch my legs." Gary pulled the car into a spot in a slightly less crowded section of the parking lot just around the corner from the main entrance.
"I'll wait on you guys here," Randy said. "I need to smoke more than I need to pee."
We approached the front entrance, and it was clear that the place was a madhouse. I could hear raised voices from the line of cars waiting on the pumps as people cursed and complained. There was a constant stream of people going in and out of the door. My plan had been to take a leak and get a drink, maybe a candy bar. But it was apparent from the line waiting to check out that I was probably not going to be making any purchases. I didn't think I was going to wait for the bathroom either, but I stood around for a minute just checking out the scene. You could tell things were right at the edge of chaos. The frustration and urgency of the crowd was like an electrical charge in the air just before a lightning strike. At the register, a customer was arguing with one of the clerks about the fuel purchase limit. A red-faced man in a sleeveless Jeff Gordon t-shirt and baggy denim shorts was pointing his finger at the cashier and complaining loudly. The angry customer said he needed more gas to get home. The frustrated clerk explained that they were not sure when they could get more gas and had to limit sales to make sure that everyone who needed gas could at least get some.
5 gallons does not fucking help me,
the man said, raising his voice. How the hell am I going to get to Tennessee on 5 gallons?
Sorry, the clerk said. I can't do anything about it. It's company policy because of the attacks. You need to move along or I'm going to call the police.
Impatient people in line behind the man began shouting at him, urging him to pay up and move on so they could do the same. The man cursed back at the crowd, giving them all the finger. I could see Lois waiting in line for the restroom with a disgusted look on her face. Alice, who'd been riding with Lois, came walking toward me.
I was going to go too, but I think I'll take my chances elsewhere. I'd rather pee behind a bush than wait in this mess, she said. I'll be in the car.
I'll be out in a second, I said. I'm going to stick around and wait on Rebecca and Lois. I was still watching the altercation at the registers when Gary touched me on the shoulder. When I looked to see what he wanted, he pointed outside the front entrance to the store. I turned in that direction. 2 Virginia State Troopers had pulled in with blue lights flashing immediately behind Lois's car, blocking it and several others in. A trooper emerged from each vehicle, placing their hats carefully on their heads. The lead trooper strode through the door, followed quickly by the 2nd trooper, whom I noticed carried his 12-gauge riot gun. The gun lay up on his shoulder, the way a hunter might carry it. The troopers headed straight for the registers.
"Glad you parked away from the entrance," I said.
The man who had been arguing at the counter turned toward the troopers, raised his hands, and stammered,
I was just leaving.
He bolted for the door. The 2 troopers looked at each other briefly, shrugged, and then faced the crowd. Apparently, they weren't here for that guy.
"Excuse me, folks," the trooper said. "By order of the governor of Virginia, all fuel sales in the Commonwealth will be temporarily halted, effective immediately. If you have filled your vehicle, you may pay and leave, but no further sales will be made. All gas and diesel fuel is reserved for authorized emergency vehicles only."
There was a moment of silence while this sank in. There were folks waiting in line for the bathroom who had not pumped gas yet. There were folks getting food who were intending to get gas but had not done so yet. These people immediately became very, very pissed. Limiting gas to 5 gallons was bad, but cutting off all sales was even worse. Interstate 81 was a major corridor, and these people were from all over the country. How would they get home? What would they do? The crowd had been smoldering, and the trooper had just thrown gasoline on the fire. I was just getting ready to tell Gary that I was going back outside when things went south in a hurry. An angry patron behind a rack of Terry's potato chips threw an unopened plastic soda bottle at the trooper who had made the announcement. It bounced off his Kevlar vest. The trooper immediately stepped toward the man who had thrown the bottle, but he took off through the store, pushing over the rack of chips and bumping into several people as he ran.
"We need to get out of here," I told Gary.
"I'll get Rebecca and Lois," he replied, moving toward the restroom line.
Someone else threw a soup can they had snatched off a shelf and caught the remaining trooper in the face. A cut opened over his eye, and his nose started bleeding. Another soup can came flying from the same direction but missed. The trooper raised his shotgun and fired blindly in the direction that he thought the soup cans came from. With people packed so tightly, the buckshot hit several bystanders. An innocent woman died when she took a buckshot pellet to the forehead and dropped like a rock. Her husband, a decorated veteran of the Korean War, had lost his only daughter to a drunk driver 20 years before, and immediately felt he had nothing left to live for at this point. He pulled a .357 Magnum revolver from his jacket pocket and began firing at the trooper with the shotgun at a distance of less than 10 feet. The trooper caught rounds in his protective vest and toppled backward. The other trooper, still chasing the man who'd hit him with a soda bottle, spun toward the gunfire and saw the old man emptying his revolver at his fellow trooper. He drew his SIG and put 2 rounds in the armed man, dropping him in a heap across his wife. More guns came out, and the chaos escalated. Truckers and travelers were all pulling out their concealed carry weapons and trying to defend themselves as they ran for the exits. Wild rounds flew in all directions. The trooper with the shotgun tried to shake off the rounds he'd taken to the vest and began firing at anyone he saw carrying a gun. More bodies fell. Though people were screaming and crying, some were shooting back. The trooper with the SIG fired a round into the ceiling and tried to regain control of the situation. He yelled at everyone to cease fire, but the situation was too far gone. Gary had gripped Lois and Rebecca by the arms, rushing them toward the exit. I stood just outside the front door, trying to avoid the onrush of people and the sporadic gunfire. I was staring at the blocked vehicle Lois and Alice had been traveling in, wondering what the hell we were going to do about it. When I turned to Gary to tell him to hurry up, Lois opened her mouth to say something to me. I knew it because she was looking me dead in the eye. As the first word formed in her mouth, a stray round caught her in the temple, spraying Rebecca with blood and dropping Lois dead to the ground. Rebecca paused for a second, staring at the dead woman beside her and recoiling in horror. She started to scream, but Gary jerked her arm and they ran out the door. They joined me just outside the door, and we all stared at Alice sitting in the blocked vehicle. She hadn't seen Lois fall, but she knew that all hell had broken loose from the continuing gunfire inside and the people streaming from the door. She looked frozen in panic. I waved at Alice, and she opened her door. "Come on," I yelled at her. "We have to go." She put one leg out of the car and rose up out of her open door. I ran over and took her by the arm. "We have to go. Lois is dead. This car isn't going anywhere." "My stuff is..." "Forget your stuff, Alice. We have to go now." She looked at me, wild-eyed in fear and shock, then snatched her purse from the front seat. We ducked and ran past the front door, where shots still rang out, though they were tapering off. Gary and Rebecca were already in the car with the engine running when we got there. Randy had jumped in the back seat when the shooting started and still had no idea of what was going on. I got in the front seat while Alice crammed in the back with the other two women. They were unable to speak, except for Randy, who kept asking what had happened, but she wasn't getting any answers. Gary started the engine, reversed the vehicle, and drove quickly around the back of the store, hoping to avoid the chaos around front. Truck drivers were running back and forth between vehicles, some with pistols in their hands. Others were getting their rigs moving and hoping to get out of here before things got any worse. Gary cut around the slow-moving rigs but got caught in a bottleneck trying to get out of the parking lot. Cars were streaming out onto the road, but there were hundreds of cars still in this parking lot with only one way in and out. "Come on, come on," Gary whispered, as if he could urge a clearing in the traffic. Out of nowhere, a man ran up to Gary's window and began beating on it. "Do not lower that window," I said urgently. The man was screaming at Gary. "My car is out of gas. I need a ride out of here. This is a government vehicle, and my damn taxes paid for it." Gary held up his hands and yelled back, "We don't have room." In the back, Rebecca started crying. The shock of seeing Lois killed beside her and the continuing chaos becoming too much for her. "Open this damn door," the man screamed. Gary tried to inch the car forward, but was pinned in and couldn't go anywhere. The man pulled a lug wrench from his back pocket, drew back, and shattered Gary's window, showering Gary and me with glass fragments. Gary leaned forward and was brushing them from his hair and face, trying to keep them out of his eyes. Without thinking, I threw open my door, drew my LCP, and pointed it at the man as he drew back the lug wrench again for what I assumed was to be a fatal blow to Gary's head. There was no time to say anything. I leveled the pistol, fired twice. The 380 rounds went through the man's right pectoral muscle and into his chest. He grabbed his chest and dropped from sight. It was the first time I'd ever shot a person, and time slowed. In my peripheral vision, I saw the car ahead of us pull onto the road. To my left, I could see the car behind us, a man and woman in the front seat, staring wide-eyed in horror. "In the car," Gary yelled. "Let's go." I ducked into the seat, hearing glass fragments grind beneath me. I still had the LCP in my hand. Gary hit the gas, and the tires squealed as we sped onto the road and took the on-ramp for I-81 South. The women were silent. Even Rebecca's crying had stopped. Gary kept looking over at me.
"You may want to put that away," he said after a moment.
Chapter 5. When Ellen and the kids arrived home, she sent Pete for Jim's Simplicity lawnmower and the garden cart that he towed behind it. They set the propane tanks, Coleman fuel, gas cans, and diesel cans out of the vehicle. "Store the gas and diesel in the mower building," Ellen said. "Just leave them in the middle of the floor for now until I can add fuel stabilizer to the gas. Then I need you to come back for the propane cylinders, the Coleman fuel, and the camping stuff. Put it in the new storage building and make sure that it's locked when you're done. Got it? Ariel and I are going to take the groceries inside." Pete saluted. "Got it, Mom." While people like Jim were called preppers today, he came from a long line of hillbillies that knew that hard times were always just around the corner. His father and grandfather had been people who never threw anything away and tried not to own things they couldn't fix themselves. While she shook her head at the various junk and scrap piles that Jim maintained around the property, she never complained about them. There would have been no point in it, for one thing. Jim was his own man and probably wouldn't get rid of his personal junkyard for any amount of persuasion. But beyond that, there had been countless circumstances where he'd repaired something using material scavenged from his piles, or built something he needed from scratch simply by using those salvaged or discarded materials. There had been some boom times in central Appalachia where they lived, but far more bust times. So people were never that far from raising their own food, home canning, and hunting. When he'd built this house on 50 acres of overgrown farmland, Jim had taken all those things into account, even though farming and hunting were not activities he actively pursued now. There were deer, turkeys, and squirrels on the land. He had a pond stocked with bass, trout, catfish, bluegill, and several other species. He had a garden which could easily be expanded if the need arose. There was also a spring that could provide fresh water year-round. If things ever got desperate enough, there was even a cave at the back of the property that could serve as an emergency shelter. As a weekend project, Jim had taken pallets of old cinder blocks he'd salvaged from buildings that were being torn down and walled up the entrance to the cave. After laying the blocks most of the way up, he threaded scraps of rebar and old steel fence posts down through the block cores to lock them together. Then he filled the voids with a wet concrete mixture to grout them solid, and had installed a salvaged steel door in the wall. With the door's metal frame also grouted in concrete, it was a very solid entrance, and would be impenetrable to most things that might try to gain entrance. When he ran out of room for cinder blocks, he filled any irregular voids with mortar, sealing his wall tight to the rock outcropping. It took them nearly an hour to unload and put away the purchases. As part of Jim's design, the house had a large pantry near the kitchen door that allowed them to store their food in an easily accessible location. There were also shelves in the basement for long-term stored food, bulk foods, and some of the home canned items. "I'm going to go lie down and watch TV," Ariel announced when they were done, her voice weak with feigned exhaustion. Ellen reheated a cup of coffee for herself and took Jim's red binder to the porch. She sat in the porch swing and opened the book to where she'd left off. "If you still have power, you'll need to charge all items that can be charged in case you lose power down the road. In the mower shed are a couple of boat batteries and old car batteries. You should charge these since they can be a good source of 12-volt power in an emergency. The charger is beside them, and the instructions are printed on the charger. There's also a solar charger hanging on the wall by the batteries. If the power goes out, you can use this charger to charge these batteries, but it takes a lot longer. Charge all phones, entertainment devices, and the radios. The walkie-talkies can use AA batteries in a pinch, but you might as well charge them if you have the power. Also, charge the batteries to the power tools. They're on a shelf in the basement. They charge in about 15 minutes, so try to charge all of them if you can. In the new storage unit is the device I use to jump-start dead batteries. It has an air compressor, a USB charger, and a radio built in. Make sure this is charged. It's the easiest way to recharge a cell phone if the power is out. If the power does fail, use duct tape to seal the chest freezers in the basement. They'll keep for about a week or so if you don't open them. You can extend this if you use the generator and run them for a couple of hours a day. Remember, though, in an extended power outage, the sound of a generator running carries for long distances and can make you a target, so be aware. If you do use the generator, it needs to be chained up, and you should cover it with a tarp when it's not running. There are rolls of black plastic in one of the outbuildings. It might not be a bad idea to cover the windows on the front of the house with this plastic to prevent anyone from seeing that the house is lit when theirs is not. Items in the refrigerator won't last more than a day if you're opening the door at all, which is hard to avoid. If the power's out and there's no indication of when it'll be coming back on, load all of the refrigerated items into boxes and take them to the spring house. There's a 12-volt cooler in the storage building that can be hooked to one of those old boat batteries. It will allow you to keep a few refrigerated items in the house for your convenience. You'll have to switch the battery out and recharge them using the solar charger. Since their property had a spring on it, Jim had insisted on building a spring house like his grandmother had. It was a cinder block building set back into the hillside with a shallow concrete trough inside. Cold spring water flowed from a pipe in the wall and into the trough. At the other end, a drain allowed the water to flow out, providing a constant level of cold running water. By setting items that needed refrigeration into the trough, they remained at a cool temperature year-round. With the spring house set back into the hillside, with three walls mostly buried, the spring house also didn't freeze in the winter, so it made for near-perfect storage in the case of a power failure. They used it for storing garden potatoes and other root vegetables mostly, but it was there for refrigeration if they needed it. Ellen's reading was interrupted by a loud shriek of frustration. "Mom!" Ariel yelled from inside. "What?" Ellen asked. "What's going on?"
"My TV just quit working," Ariel yelled back.
"Well, shit," Ellen said. She felt free to curse when the kids weren't standing around her. She got up and went through the screen door into the living room. She flipped the switch on the wall. Nothing. She was starting to get worried now. She went back outside and walked around the house to the electric meter mounted on the wall where the power came in. The digital readout was blank. She knew exactly what that meant. No power. She couldn't help but think she may have jinxed herself by reading the power failure instructions in Jim's binder in advance. This changed things significantly. Now she knew she would have to finish that section. There would be preparations to make before darkness fell. Without electric lights, life was about to turn into an extended camping trip. She hoped she was up to it. "Kids," she yelled, entering the house, "we have more work to do." Chapter 6
"Y'all, that was some seriously fucked up shit," Randy said, plain-spoken as always.
"What the hell just happened? What happened to Lois?"
No one spoke. As the magnitude of the events settled in, we dropped into a collective state of shock and numbness. The radio was still playing, and I leaned forward and turned it off. Rebecca turned to Randy and took a deep breath. Her voice shook as she spoke.
"Lois is dead. She was shot while we were leaving."
"Are you sure she was dead?" Randy asked.
"Maybe she was just wounded."
"She was standing right beside me," Rebecca said, her voice rising in anger and frustration. "I saw the bullet take out part of her skull. I'm wearing her blood and brains."
Randy stared at Rebecca for a moment, as if just noticing her state, then spoke to her softly.
"Honey, you do have blood all over your face."
Rebecca started crying again and scrubbed at her face with her jacket sleeve. Randy dug in her purse and removed a pack of baby wipes.
"I have grandkids," she said.
You have grandkids, you always have wipes. She removed one and began wiping the blood from Rebecca's face as if it were nothing more than chocolate.
You don't look old enough to have grandkids, Rebecca said absently, still tearful.
I got an early start, Randy said. Had my first child at 16. No one said anything while Randy finished cleaning Rebecca's face. When she was done, she had about a half dozen bloody wipes in her lap. She stared at them for a moment.
Would anyone be offended if I littered? She asked. I don't feel like riding home with this mess in my lap.
Go ahead, I said. It was the first thing I'd said since shooting that guy.
So, okay, someone please tell me what happened, Randy said again. Why did someone shoot Lois?
Gary started telling the story and left out nothing. No one interrupted. When he was done, Alice took out her cell phone and dialed a number.
I've got to try to call Bill, she said.
Bill was our executive director, the head honcho of our state agency.
I've got to let him know what happened, that Lois is dead and that we've had to abandon a vehicle.
And that I had to shoot someone, I said. You may want to mention that little detail.
You had no choice, Randy assured me. Did you see the way he had that tire iron drawn back? If you hadn't shot him, Gary would have been toast, and we'd have two dead people instead of one.
I can't believe we had to leave her there, Rebecca said to no one in particular.
How will her body ever get back to her family? How will they bury her?
No one answered, all of us thinking about what she had said and not having an answer.
No offense, Jim, Randy said, but if you can carry a damn gun in this car, then I think I should be able to smoke a damn cigarette, and I need one about now.
She pulled one from her pack, cracked her window, and lit up. No one protested or quoted the policy manual. A loud dinging noise startled all of us.
I was waiting on that, Gary said, his voice full of dread. We're low on fuel.
Things were quiet for a moment, and then the dinging started again.
We could try this next exit, I said. Try a small town gas station.
Maybe, Gary said. It's possible they wouldn't know yet that they're not supposed to be selling gas. Or maybe they'd sell us some anyway if we pay a little extra. I can't imagine they'd be able to put cops at every single gas station in the state.
We've got to do something, Randy said.
This car ain't going much further without gas. I've been noticing a lot of cars pulled over like they're out of gas, and I don't want to be one of them.
It was true. We were passing more and more cars stopped on the shoulder of the road. Some had people inside or milling around outside. Others appeared abandoned. The surrounding traffic had thinned out considerably, too. There were a lot fewer moving vehicles. It was likely that the fuel restrictions were starting to have an effect. There were still convoys of National Guard and Army vehicles passing on the other side of the interstate heading north, as well as the occasional police car going by with lights flashing. Alice gave up on her phone call.
I can't get through, she said.
Did you try texting? I asked.
No, but I will, she said, and started thumbing a message on the screen of her phone.
This reminded me that I had not tried to contact my own family since leaving Richmond. I pulled out my cell and composed a quick text. On 81, can't buy gas anymore. Hope you guys are safe. Be home as soon as I can. I wanted to say more, but didn't want to worry them.
How do you text your wife that you just had to kill someone in a parking lot? How do you tell her one of your colleagues got shot waiting on the restroom?
I was going to have to snap out of this. I knew it was just the after effects of adrenaline, but I'd been in a funk since shooting that guy. I knew I was only doing what I had to do, but there's a physical reaction that first time, and you never know how it's going to go. This is what I trained for when I practiced shooting, though. Being able to respond automatically in times of stress and danger. You create muscle memory so your body knows what to do. I'd performed just as I had to. With the man's arm drawn back, there was no time for a warning. The lug wrench was a deadly weapon, and I'd responded with deadly force. There was nothing to be worried about. If things got as bad as I was afraid they might be,
and I'd be lucky if I only had to kill one man. That was not an encouraging thought. It was at this time that I heard my grandfather's voice in my head, telling me I needed to harden the fuck up. He'd died when I was 15, but he'd always been an icon of toughness to me. He'd lost his father and older siblings in the Spanish flu epidemic, and at age 10 had become the man of the house, assuming responsibility for his mother and four younger brothers and sisters. He'd been forced by circumstance to go to work in the coal mines of West Virginia as a slate picker, sitting with other children atop wooden boards that were placed over the conveyors of coal. Their job was to pick chunks of slate out of the coal that moved down the conveyor belt. It was hard, dirty work, and a man with a long stick stood ready to strike them if their attention lapsed. There were child labor laws in place at this time meant to curtail these practices, but these were circumvented by putting the child's hours on an adult relative's paycheck. That relative would then split the money with the child's family. My grandfather kept this job until he was 12, when he was promoted to leading mules down into the mines, pulling coal carts on narrow steel tracks. This, too, was dirty, dangerous work. As a child, living in an adult world, he was forced to fight his way through life early, with his fists at the beginning, then later with a knife, and later yet, with a gun. When I turned 13, my grandfather, without my mother's knowledge, began recounting to me the stories of the men he'd killed and wounded over his lifetime. There were many, and these experiences had made him a hard man, physically and mentally. I still remember the stories of all those men, and I remember him telling me that I had to be a hard man, too, because there were men in the world who needed killing. Men you could not turn your back on. Men you could not leave behind to ambush you when the odds were better in their favor. "There's an exit," Gary said. "A minor one with no hotels and no fast food. Just what we're looking for. Probably fewer people stop because there's not much there." Gary took the exit. A sign pointed right and told us that it was 3.5 miles to the nearest gas station. Gary turned in that direction. "You guys sure this is a good idea?" Rebecca asked. "The interstate seems safer." "No," I said. "I'm not sure it's safe at all. Do you have a better idea?" No one said anything for a moment. "Maybe we should have just gone as far as we could on the interstate," Alice said. "We could have stopped at an exit with a hotel and stayed there until we could get help." "I'm not sure we'd be better off," I said. "I'm afraid those exits will become dangerous as more and more people gather there and become desperate. If no help comes, people will turn on each other. The cops are all tied up, and you can't depend on them for help." Rebecca had quit crying, but was still absently wiping the side of her face where the blood had been, as if some invisible remnant remained. "We survived the 9/11 attacks, and things didn't get that bad then," she said. "People weren't shooting at each other."
"Those attacks killed a lot of people, but we didn't lose resources," Gary said, before I could answer. "This attack has damaged concrete resources along with a significant loss of life. It could take years to recover from this. If those attacks destroyed enough transformers, it could take 2 years to replace them. If power isn't available to manufacture more, who knows how long it could be?"
"I think you're overreacting," Alice said. "There's no need to scare people like that."
"We'll see," I said skeptically. "I hope we're overreacting." We drove less than a mile before the Impala rounded a corner and encountered a roadblock consisting of two sheriff's department cruisers parked nose to nose, blocking both lanes of traffic. Gary slowed as we approached, and a deputy with what looked like a Remington 870 shotgun moved from behind the barricade, eyeing us carefully. When we came to a stop, the cop stared at our local government tags, the same type his cruiser carried. The deputy approached cautiously.
"What can I do for you folks?" he asked.
"We're just looking for some gas," Gary said in his friendliest tone. "We're on our way back home from Richmond and are getting pretty low."
The deputy lowered his head a little and got a good look at each of us, then lowered his gun, not perceiving us as a threat.
"You might not have heard," the deputy said,
but the governor has locked down the gas supply. All available gas is for official emergency response only.
I leaned over to Gary, to where I could see the deputy's face.
Any chance of a tank out of professional courtesy? I asked. We're local government, too.
The deputy considered this.
What branch? He asked. Where are you guys from?
Mental health.
Alice spoke up before I could answer him.
Russell County, near Bristol.
I'd been prepared to say emergency services or county government on our way back from a conference, something that sounded more official, more critical. Anything but mental health. Cops didn't give a crap about mental health workers.
Mental health, he sneered. Not a chance in hell.
What difference does it make that we're mental health? Alice asked.
Do you know how many times we call you guys to get someone committed to a mental hospital and you say they don't meet the criteria? He asked. It happens around here every day.
Sorry, Alice said. This isn't our area. You can't blame us for what your local agency does.
No dice. You folks will need to turn your car around and go the other way.
Why the roadblock? Gary asked. I'm just curious.
We were getting overrun by folks trying the same thing you folks were trying, looking for someone to sell you gas. When they couldn't find anyone who would sell them gas, they started trying to steal gas. My old mom called me and said she saw someone drive up to her house and cut off a section of her water hose and then use it to siphon gas out of her Buick. When I got there, the guy looks at me as if he was doing nothing wrong. He told me he was doing what he had to do.
So you're not letting anyone else come in, Gary said.
Damn right we're not, the deputy said. Local traffic only.
You'll find that a lot of towns off the interstate are doing the same thing. I've heard talk of it on the radio.
We'll be getting out of here then, Gary said.
Good luck.
You folks will be the ones needing luck, the deputy replied. Russell County is a hell of a long way away, and travel just got a lot harder.
With little choice, we drove back to the interstate. Each ding of the low fuel alert hit me like a blow to the stomach.
What the hell were we going to do?
I guess we might as well try to get as far as we can, Gary said.
No one had any other comments or suggestions. We were all getting hungry and more than a little scared. Most business trips sucked, but this one was off the charts. We ended up being able to travel another 15 miles or so before the gas tank was dry. In a curve, the fuel pump sucked air, and the engine missed. It smoothed out again when we came out of the curve and we all started breathing again. Then the engine stuttered again, and the car stalled completely. Gary put the car in neutral and coasted to the side of the road, off the paved shoulder and onto a level grass spot beside the road.
Maybe if we leave it here, they won't tow it, he said, scrounging for a piece of paper. I'll leave a note in the window.
What do we do now? Rebecca asked. Sit here?
No, Alice said. I guess we walk to the nearest hotel.
If they don't have power, they might not be accepting new guests, but we can at least try, I said.
I'd rather be moving than just sitting here waiting. We all got out of the car and stood, stretching. A single semi-truck passed by and disappeared over the next hill, and it was the only vehicle visible. That was definitely unusual for a busy interstate like this one. Gary popped the trunk, and we all stared at the luggage.
At least I don't have to worry about carrying a suitcase, Alice said. Mine is still in the other car.
She was more than a little sarcastic. For the first time, it was hitting her that all she had with her were the things she carried in her purse.
But you're alive, Gary reminded her.
She didn't say anything.
I think we should go through our bags and lose a few things, I said. It could be a long walk, and carrying a suitcase will suck.
I got my suitcase from the car and found a slightly more private spot in the grass away from the car to consolidate what I was taking with me.
Well, that's convenient, Randy said, noticing the pack in my hand for the first time. You brought a backpack.
I brought one, too, Gary said. I never travel without one.
I don't either, I said.
Why?
Randy asked.
Boy Scout.
Gary said simply. I like to be prepared.
I'm just paranoid, I said.
I can appreciate that, Randy said. Remember, it's not paranoia if people really are out to get you.
Gary retrieved his backpack and suitcase and set about doing the same thing I was. I loosened the expansion straps on my backpack to let it accept more cargo. From my suitcase, I took my toiletries kit, but left my shampoo and shaving items in there. I'd never cared much for shaving, and it wasn't a priority now. I took all the spare socks and underwear I had, a spare pair of pants, T-shirt, and the rain shell that I carried in there in case the weather turned nasty during a trip. After sealing up my pack, I closed the suitcase and returned it to the trunk.
"Did you guys thin down your load?" I asked the women.
All I saw was shaking heads. I raised an eyebrow.
"Our suitcases have wheels," Rebecca said. "Randy and I are just going to pull ours for now. If they get too heavy, we can always throw stuff out later."
"Is there anything from the car we might need?" Gary asked, preparing to lock up.
"The policy requires that all the vehicles carry emergency kits in the trunk," Alice said.
"Policy again," I muttered, rolling my eyes.
"Sometimes policy can be a good thing," Alice replied.
I looked in the trunk and found a first aid kit still sealed in shrink wrap and stuffed it inside my pack. There was also a plastic box about the size of a tool kit. Inside was a flashlight. I tried it and got a weak yellow glow from the bulb. Although I had a better flashlight and a headlamp in my pack, I stuck this flashlight in there too. I also got a pair of Siloam light sticks, two highway flares, and a thin plastic poncho from the box. All of it went into the pack.
"Why are you carrying all that crap with you?" Rebecca asked. "We're heading to a hotel."
She was clearly unaware of how potentially serious things were becoming, and I was becoming more and more aggravated with people not getting the big picture.
"Didn't seeing Lois get shot make it clear to you that things are not the same anymore?" I asked. "You may think that was an exception, but I would bet you anything that chaos and violence will become the rule. This is not the same world you woke up to yesterday. You might as well accept it now, otherwise the next few weeks are going to be really hard for you."
Rebecca stared back at me coldly, tears welling in her eyes.
"You don't need to talk to her like that, Jim," Alice said, her voice a little too much like a schoolteacher for my taste. "None of us are children here."
"Then quit thinking like children," I said. "I'm a little concerned that you aren't all grasping the seriousness of the situation."
"Well, just because we don't choose to respond in the same way you do does not mean we're not aware of how serious it is," Alice said. "People have to deal with things in their own way."
"As long as they deal with them," I said. "Ignoring the circumstance is not dealing with things."
"You are so argumentative," Alice said. "Why do you have to be this way? You're this way all the time. Do you just hate people? Remember, there's no I in team."
"Yeah," I said, "but there is an I in bitch, and that's what she's acting like." I gave up there. There was no use continuing. They would either wake up or not. I couldn't make them. I didn't really give a shit whether they got it or not. My only concern was getting home to my family. And maybe I did hate people, after all. I slung my pack over my shoulder and headed off down the road. It felt good to be using my muscles and burning off some of the stress of the day. I was an avid hiker and backpacker, and something about walking with a pack on always felt very comfortable to me. I walked ahead of the group, energized by my anger and the fact that I was no longer caged up in the car. I never was a good car traveler and hated confinement of any sort. I could hear Rebecca and Alice speaking in low tones behind me. I heard the words paranoid and concerned thrown around. To hell with them, I thought. I was heading home, and I was going to make it alive. They could either go with me or not. I was not responsible for them and would have preferred not to be saddled with them. Randy was okay, but I had little use for the other two.
Let them travel for a while in their little bubble, and we'd see how far they made it before it got pricked. I knew from years of traveling this road that we were about 5 miles from the nearest exit. It was around noon, and the early summer sun was high overhead. It was not miserable yet, but we were getting warm from the heat reflecting back off the pavement as we plodded down the shoulder of the road. I had some water in the pack that I wasn't going to use unless things got desperate. Same for food. I had some energy bars, some ramen and packaged macaroni, a few other items. I was sure Gary was equally supplied, but neither of us had ever expected we would have to supply a group. Though we hadn't discussed it, I expected he felt the same. There was just not enough in our packs for everyone, so best to keep our preparations low-key. I pulled out my cell phone and checked for signal. 1 bar. I composed a quick text to my wife and sent it. Unsure if it went through or not, I left the phone powered on and stuck it back in its holster. If she got my message and replied, I didn't want to miss it. After 3 miles, we had passed several abandoned vehicles, but no people. We were passed by an ambulance and a few semis. The semi-trucks appeared to be holding out longer, since their diesel tanks had a larger capacity. It would be a little longer before they hit crisis state. The scary part was that when those trucks quit running, goods would no longer be reaching store shelves, and regular food supplies would be interrupted. People who had not made preparations would start going hungry. I'd traveled a lot of interstate highways in my life, and this section was as generic as they got. Woods on both sides, with occasional glimpses of open field at times. No houses, no signs of life, no personality, just open road. At one point, a convoy of armed National Guard troops passed us in the other lane. They didn't look very excited. They were probably concerned about leaving their families behind this mess, too. I know I would be. I wondered how many had not showed up for duty. Once, Alice had stuck her thumb out when a semi passed, but the truck had not even slowed down. I started to tell her that under the circumstances it might take a more impressive display to get a trucker to stop, but I didn't want to hear about what policies I might be violating with my comment. I topped a hill and approached another stalled vehicle on the shoulder ahead, and I could see that this one was occupied. I glanced back and saw the rest of my group was clustered together about 50 yards behind me. I raised my shirt tail so I could put my hand on the grip of my Ruger LCP and carefully approached the car. "Hello?" I called once I was close enough to be heard. I could see movement in the vehicle as a large man struggled to get out. He was around 70, tall and neatly dressed. He was red-faced from the heat beating down on his car.
"Hello, young man," he said, his booming voice carrying a little weariness at the moment.
It reminded me of my dad. "You all right?" I asked. "You look a little warm."
"No, I'm okay," he said. "I am a little concerned about my wife."
The man moved stiffly around the back of his car, heading for the passenger side, then stopped and stuck out his hand to shake.
"I'm Jack, by the way, and my wife there is Ruth."
I relaxed and took my hand off the weapon. I took his hand and shook it. "I'm Jim." Jack turned again, and I followed him around to the passenger side of the car. He leaned through the open passenger door and spoke to someone, then straightened and turned back to me.
"My wife just had surgery yesterday at UVA at Charlottesville," he said. "They discharged her this morning, and we were on our way back to Roanoke when we ran out of gas. Every damn place we stopped was either out or wouldn't sell us any."
"And we ran into the same thing," I explained. "We're trying to walk to the next exit."
"I thought to do the same thing," he said. "There's no way my wife can make it, though. She's too weak. She's got stitches from the surgery and is on medication. I'm worried about her being out here. We don't have any food or water or even any shade."
I dropped my pack and dug into it. I had an 8-pack of 12-ounce water bottles that were part of my get-home bag. I hadn't touched them yet since things weren't chaotic, but these folks were looking a little desperate. I took out two water bottles and handed them to the man. "It's not much," I said, "but it's something."
"Oh, God bless you," he said, uncapping a bottle and hurrying to put it to his wife's lips.
I could tell she was weak. She didn't even raise her own hand to help hold the bottle. I started to ask the man what he was going to do, but it was clear that he didn't know, and I didn't have any suggestions. It was a question better left unasked. When the rest of my group topped the hill, I pointed them out to the man. "Those folks are with me. We were at a meeting in Richmond and are trying to get back home."
"How far do you have to go?"
the man asked, opening his own water bottle now and taking a drink.
"All the way across the state," I said. "Russell County."
The man shook his head.
"Long damn way."
"It's a long way even if you're driving," I said. "A lot longer if you're walking." When my group was together, I explained the situation to them, and Randy said she wanted to look at the lady. "I'm an LPN," she said, heading for the passenger door. "I didn't know that," I said to no one in particular. "Good to know, though." Randy was back in a moment. "She's way too hot, and her pulse is weak. He's got some blankets and a pillow in the car. I want to make her a bed on the ground beside the car in the shade. It'll at least be out of the heat of that car. It's got to be 120 in there, even with the doors open. Her clothes are soaked with sweat." "You make the bed. Gary and I'll help Jack with getting her situated." When we had the woman lifted out and comfortable, Alice approached me. My chest constricted with tension the moment she drew near. It was the first time we'd spoken directly since the earlier confrontation, and I assumed she was ready to pick up where we left off. "Are we just going to leave them here?" she asked.
"What do you propose?" I said, putting it back in her lap.
"I don't know," she said. "They'll die if we leave them here."
"To be blunt, they'll probably die anyway," I said. "At least the woman will. If things are as bad as they said on the radio, people who require medication may not be able to depend on a regular supply much longer."
Alice looked me in the eye. "That's pretty harsh. My mom is a diabetic," she said. "Are you saying she might not be able to live through this?" I ignored the comment, not wanting to speculate on the fate of her family. "They remind me of my own parents," I said. "I'd like to help them. But that lady's over 200 pounds, and I can't carry her 2 miles. Can you?" Alice didn't answer. In her job, she often had to handle complex situations, and I knew it was eating at her. Here was a problem, and she wanted to solve it. Needed to solve it. Even though she got on my nerves sometimes, she was an excellent problem solver. However, problems had just gotten a lot harder to solve. "Maybe we can come back for them later or bring them something," she suggested. "Maybe we can," I replied. "I'd be willing to do that if we're able to stay at the next exit for the night." I was not sure that either of those things would happen, but I didn't know what else to say. When we prepared to leave, I shook the man's hand and told him what Alice and I talked about.
"I keep thinking that someone will stop," he said. "I've tried to flag down several police cars, but no one will stop."
It was clear that this was a man who could just not comprehend the current circumstances. He didn't have a frame of reference for a world in which the police would not stop and help a lady in need. I patted him on the shoulder, gathered my gear, and joined my crew at the front of the car. We walked off in silence, not happy about leaving those poor elderly folks, but unable to do anything for them. This would not be the last time we would have to leave people to their fate. Chapter 7 The kids had not been excited about being recalled into duty. The day had gone downhill for them since the start, being dragged out of bed on a summer morning, having to go to the grocery store, and then carry in those same groceries. And now there were even more tasks. Ariel and Pete both entered the living room dragging their feet, stumbling loose-limbed with pleading looks in their eyes. Ellen took one look at them and burst out laughing. They were always both comical and predictable.
After what I heard from your father and on the news, she said, there's the possibility that the power will not be back on soon.
Both children rolled their eyes and moaned a near-death rattle.
There's work that will have to be done unless you want to be caught unprepared in the dark. Dad left me a list of what needed done, and